Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson. I brought in somebody that I know well since he's my brother, filling in for Mike Cosentino today. And Chuck managed multi-billion-dollar bank funds. He was the CFO, chief financial officer of the largest bank in Oklahoma, was it, when you were there?
Yes, it was at the time.
And you worked for a whole number of institutions. He comes from the business side of economics. And so today we have Tom Paley. Tom Paley got his undergraduate degree from Oxford. He got his PhD from Yale. He's worked for a whole series of things, from governmental commissions on China-U.S. relations to different think tanks. He's now working with the New America Foundation. We've had Tom on before, and we're going to be talking to him about economics. He has a new book out, which is a lot less expensive than his last book. A very distinguished publisher, Tom, on your last book, but it was $60 on Amazon. So
I wish I could do something about that, but the book monopoly. We'll bring out a paperback next year.
Yeah, or if you can get it on Kindle or something, because $60 is a lot of money to lay out for an economic book.
We have a depressed economy in Northern
Ireland. You're feeling my pain.
I like one of the quotes of one of your articles, and the quote is, "It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future, Yogi Berra." How did you do in predicting the housing crisis and the factors that brought down the economy back in 2008?
Well, I think I did pretty well, actually. When I'm looking back at the things I wrote then, it amazes me how current they are, how they still read so well, and particularly the two things that I think I identified the bubble. Of course, one of the features of a bubble is that you never know when they are going to burst. All that the good economists can do is identify one in place and warn people, and I was writing along those lines.
But you can't predict the time. In other words, you didn't know when it was going to happen. You see the housing bubble build and build and build, but you have no idea.
It's like a Ponzi scheme, Steve. A Ponzi scheme, all you know is that it will eventually collapse with hundreds of people, thousands, maybe even millions, that's happened this time around, getting ripped off. But you can't predict when, and I promise you, trying to persuade people that a bubble is in place is also almost impossible, because that's what drives it. It's when finally people realize that the emperor has no clothes, that's when the thing busts.
I wanted to read a thing by Paul Krugman. He's won the Nobel Prize. And he says, on Inauguration Day in 2009, the U.S. economy faced three main problems. First and most pressing, there was a crisis in the financial system, with many crucial channels of credit frozen. So it was very much like the Great Depression or the recessions and bank runs that occurred early in the 20th century, even into the 19th century. Secondly, the economy was taking a major hit from the housing bubble, which you've just talked about. And third, consumer spending was being held down by high levels of household debt, much of which had been built up during the Bush administration. Would you agree with those? And why has the recovery been so slow?
Okay, let me say, first of all, I am a great fan of Paul Krugman's. I think he writes with eloquence, with interest, whether you disagree with him or agree with him. It's really good reading and provocative. That said, I think that Paul, on these issues, has not dug deep enough. Everything he says is true, But what he is talking about is the symptoms. And he you've got to dig a little deeper to find what was the causes. And the argument that I make in my book is that around 1980, we put in place a new economic model, call it trickle-down, call it Reaganomics, call it supply-side, call it corporate globalization, all those features. And what that did is it hollowed out the economy. That's when we start to see the emergence of wage stagnation. That's when we start to see the explosion in income inequality begin. That's when we start to hear about outsourcing and downsizing and the disappearing of manufacturing. That eroded the American middle class. And that created a problem. We were short of demand. But the demand shortage was then covered up by this process of finance. So we had a bubble after bubble after bubble. We had deficit after deficit after deficit emerging. You had the budget deficits emerging with Reaganomics. You had the stock market boom of the 1980s. You had the leverage buyout boom. In the 1990s, you had more deficits that eventually turned to surpluses, it's true. But then you had the beginning of a stock market bubble. And actually, the housing bubble, if you look at the data, really began around 1997. And all of this process, this finance, and with the Fed lowering interest rates, etc., covered up the underlying problem. But guess what? Using finance to cover up the problem created these bubbles. The biggest bubble was the housing market bubble. Using finance in this way was a sort of Ponzi scheme. And so it all exploded, and it left all the problems that Paul Krugman identified. A lot of debt. We had a problem with a bursting house price bubble, and we had a problem with the bank run because the financial system was rotten. All the three things that Paul Krugman identifies were true, but they were there because of this underlying structural problem in the nature of our economic model, hollowing out the middle class. And that's the problem, why we're not having a recovery, despite all the stimulus, the low interest rates, until we get our hands on this basic problem and fix it and bring back the middle class. Then we're going to have ongoing stagnation.
Certainly the recovery has not been robust.
Thomas, this is Chuck.
Yeah, Chuck.
You wrote in your posting the coming deep recession in March of 06 that we should finally discredit the notion that tax cuts for the rich drive growth and job creation. Why do you believe that, and what do you think of the proposed Romney-Ryan budget, which greatly further reduces the tax on the well-to-do?
Well, of course, I'm fundamentally opposed to them at two levels. First, let's talk about the sort of the trickle-down. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith had a great description of that. His argument was that trickle-down was just the old story that you feed enough oats to the horse, and some will pass through onto the road to feed the sparrow. And that's really the theory. Now, what we can say about it, we've got 30 years of experimentation in on this. You know, we've really pushed tax rates to the lowest they've been in the era since the Second World War. And we've had, during this whole time, a continuing worsening of economic performance. You know, there's a lot of talk about how fast growth was in the sort of 80s, 90s, and 2000s, but in fact it was much lower than it was in the 30 to 40 years before then. And we've also seen, and this is the next piece of it, so these taxes, they worsened, they didn't improve growth, in fact they slightly slowed growth. Then we saw a widening of income inequality, which is again part of this structural problem. And then the worst piece about it is that it has produced year after year after deficits. The idea that lowering taxes solves deficits, I mean, is absolutely amazing. I mean, it just can't possibly work, and we know it can't work, and we see it in the numbers. And, of course, so Romney and Ryan, when they say that they are for balanced budgets and then immediately propose to cut taxes in this enormous, fantastic way, it's like Bill Clinton said, it fails the arithmetic test. And I can say one more thing. By the way, if you really want to dig deep and understand these guys, and I'm going to be a bit cynical here, but they say they're for balanced budgets to exploit, I think, people's goodwill. But the reality is they've never for balanced budgets. What they do, you cut taxes, you create a deficit. You then use the deficit as an excuse to cut every single program that government does. So you go after Medicare, you go after Social Security, you go after education, you go after health, you go after all the things that government does to make us a rich and happy society, to contribute to our well-being. Now, once you do that, then you may begin to bring the budget back towards balance, as actually happened in the 1990s. That's what Bill Clinton did. They shrunk government. Remember, Bill Clinton was the guy who said the age of big government is over. Then we had surpluses in the 2000s, and immediately they say, okay, you've got a surplus, time to cut government, cut taxes again, and recreate the deficit, which is what Bush and Cheney did. So they never really want balanced budgets. All they want to do is cut taxes and actually destroy government.
Well, people like Representative Ryan seem to think that we face the crisis of becoming like Greece, that we have such huge debts on the way that we'll have foreign flight of capital and 90% interest rates or whatever. What's your take on that argument for radically reducing social benefits?
I think this would be an utter disaster. I wish he would be honest about that. If that's what he proposes, then he should go out and tell the American people that he proposes that. In fact, what again, they trade on people's goodwill and still some trust in politicians. I mean, it beats me how you can trust someone like Ryan when so much has been written about his budgets not adding up. But there are two things to say about it. Cutting the programs like that, I think I've already said one thing, would devastate so much of America, who we rely on, our senior citizens who rely on Medicare, the poor who, and not just the poor, the elderly too, who rely on Medicaid to cover, to make things up. Social Security, which is the only, you know, we were promised so much with our 401ks, et cetera, but the real piece of the retirement menu that has delivered year after year is Social Security. So cutting it will have a disastrous impact on the U.S. And cutting at a time of recession like we're in now will therefore almost certainly send us into another steep recession. I mean, if Romney and Ryan were to win, and if they were to live up to their promises, which is to cut all these programs, I'm sure we'd be heading into recession. And then the third thing about it is the U.S. never is not like Greece at a very fundamental level. We have a central bank that we will never default on our debt. That this is what Greece today does not have, a central bank. So the speculators are attacking Greece. And when they attack Greece, what they do is they drive up the interest rate. The Greek interest rate is 15%, to borrow, if it can even get access to the markets. And when you have interest rates like that, then you are driven into default. We're not in that position, and so the comparisons are completely inappropriate. They're completely misleading to anyone who hears a comparison about the U.S. being like Greece.
So the speculators basically couldn't drive the United States default.
Couldn't do it. Look at our interest rates today. They've never been lower since the Second World War.
Certainly the lowest I've seen. Explain to people a little bit. I mean, my impression, ordinary people, is that Social Security is making up more and more of their retirement. There are less retirement plans. There are less pensions. There's less everything. And that I know people who wait to get on Medicare to have an operation because they have no medical insurance. What's the economic effect of cutting those programs?
Well, I think it's the human effect. We as a society are richer than we've ever been. Our problem is that it's all being distributed to a few, so even as we've become richer, many more have become less well off and more particularly economically insecure. Cutting those programs will devastate the lives of those who rely on them, and that really is the vast majority of Americans. If Americans are going to continue to have something that we call retirement, and I believe it's a wonderful thing of modern society to have a retirement, then we will need Social Security, which delivers the necessary income, and we will need Medicare that delivers the necessary health care.
I think most people don't know that by the time you end up in a nursing home, you also end up on Medicaid if you live long enough.
That's exactly right.
It's not just for poor people. It's what happens. You'll go through all your resources to pay for your medical care, and then you'll end up on Medicaid and Medicare at the same time if you're usually in the 80s or 90s.
That's absolutely right. I mean, this is a Republican trick to sort of stigmatize small programs by associating them with certain populations and then trying to code it in that way. It's very ugly stuff.
Tom, why can't we increase Social Security rather than always? Why is it we're always talking about cutting it when what people need is better Social Security to make up for the pensions they don't have and for the fluctuations of savings, which are in 401ks, are very, very erratic?
Well, you know, that was the history of the program until the early 1980s, 1983, the Greenspan Commission, when the sort of Reaganomics took hold of people's imagination and we started using economics to hurt ourselves. There's no reason why we can't increase Social Security. What we have been doing is we've been draining Social Security of revenues. So if you go back and look at how much of sort of the national pie was taxed to provide for Social Security, back in the late 1970s when it sort of peaked, that was when, since the late 1970s, we've been running down the amount of taxes that we pay into Social Security as a share of the pie. And we do that because we have this thing called the cap on Social Security contribution. Once you get above a certain wage payment, then you don't pay Social Security on that portion above the cap. And you can see as wages have become more unequal, as incomes have become more unequal, we've been shifting income to this top group whose bulk of their income is outside of the cap, and therefore it's not taxed.
But aren't they job creators, Tom?
Well, I think we've heard enough of that yes, no jobs are created without business, but on the other hand, you have to have the right type of business. There's lots of business in this country that is about job destroying and making profits off the job destruction. So, yes, I'm completely with people who say we can only do this working with business, but we've got to put in place the right rules for business so that business's interest is aligned with the country's interest and is aligned with the interest of the middle class.
Thomas, you've written about the importance of trade deficits and the importance of manufacturing in keeping American prosperity. You said the manufacturings are clusters of knowledge, skills, and capitals that can't easily be reproduced. Talk a little bit about that and explain, for example, the auto bailout and other actions. What actions can we do to help keep manufacturing here?
Well, that's absolutely right. People should think of these manufacturing companies, of these clusters of knowledge, of people, of capital. Once the business is closed down, it's very hard to reassemble it. And that's why when we lose a factory that goes offshore, well, there are some conditions that it might come back, but in general, it's very hard to bring it back. So that's point one. A lot of our economic policy in the 1980s and 1990s and again in the 2000s, we paid no attention to our manufacturing. There was a story that the CEOs sold it. This is what their trade agreements were all about, that we're going to take manufacturing offshore and it's not going to hurt us at all. Well, it's nonsense. It did hurt us. It hurts our productivity growth. It hurts our investment. It hurts jobs that pay good wages, that have benefits. And what they were really doing is the name of the game was to take manufacturing offshore so that they could get hold of cheap labor and then sell that back as imports into the U.S. And that's why we have these huge trade deficits.
So we created an environment where capital gets additional rewards, but labor gets less.
I think
redistributed income actively through offshoring manufacturing, which I believe Mr. Romney invested in heavily.
That's what all this corporate globalization is about. And Romney and Bain Capital were big players. You know, they're players in this. Politically, they're part of it. Economically, they're part of it. And by the way, we should continue with the outstanding success of President Obama's auto bailout. It is an amazing, amazing accomplishment. that he had the courage to go ahead with the auto bailout. I promise you there were lots of people in Washington who didn't want to do it. There were people who kept on saying government going to get involved, it'll be a failure, voters won't like it. But what he did is he kept together one of the major industrial centers, major manufacturing centers in the United States. Because those companies, you've got to see what they are. Though they don't own the parts companies anymore, they are what we call assemblers. And then they assemble the parts that are made throughout the economy. So the number of jobs, the assemblers sit on top of the production line, bringing the parts together, making, assembling cars and then selling them, pushing them out to the distribution networks and so on. But think of all those manufacturing jobs that go into making the parts that those assemblers use. This was without that bailout, it is scary to think what places like Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Detroit, Michigan would all look like, that manufacturing, that auto belt. And I think it was also being said that even it's not about unions, it's not even about so much just GM, Chrysler, and Ford. All the other car companies that operate here use those same parts suppliers.
So if they had collapsed, then the parts suppliers would have been in, and it would have been a kind of like an echo chamber of job loss, right?
It would have been a domino effect, which was one company pushing down another. As you lose a crucial part supplier because it doesn't have a big enough production line now, that puts out of business another car company that's using parts from that supplier.
And the bailout polled very, very poorly. And there was you're right, there's an absolute ton of criticism of the Obama administration for doing it. Everybody said it wouldn't work. He went ahead and did it anyway, and it worked.
It's one of the amazing successes of that time, I think there's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding about what happened, and I think it was the Republicans purposely fueled that misunderstanding because its success was political poison for them.
I noticed I was reading again, I think it was Paul Krugman, but a whole lot of people have said this. The Republicans have blocked all the measures that Obama, like the Jobs Act, that would have stimulated the economy. And there's some debate, are they doing it deliberately to hold the economy back so they can win office, or do they really believe all the stuff that they say they believe?
Well, we'll never know. But, I do think that they set out to sabotage President Obama. And, they opposed him, not midterm, they opposed him from day one. The day he got into office, they went into opposition, and they blocked everything he did for 4 years. I mean, I think that this display has been a terrible display. You know, we have, in our democracy, we have the concept of the loyal opposition. We're in opposition because we have different policy beliefs and views and visions of the future, but at the same time we are a loyal opposition, so we're loyal to the president who's currently in office. And I think the Republicans broke fundamentally that concept of the loyal opposition. And let me compare here with what I'm talking about. In 2001 we had a recession too. The Republicans then were in office. It was the Bush-Cheney administration. They pushed for these Bush tax cuts that the Democrats hated and thought were bad economic policy, with good reason, in my view, because I don't think they delivered the sort of so-called stimulus that was claimed on their behalf. But the Democrats still supported them because we were in recession. This was what the president's policy was, and this is what he asked of the Congress. We never got that sort of behavior from the Republicans. I think they were out to sabotage this president, and they don't give a damn what happened to the American people as long as they eventually got back into power so that they could then begin again this regime of tax cuts for the richest.
Thomas, you've written that the U.S. economy hit a debt ice Berg, that we now are involved in deleveraging, overextended consumer debt, and you've also said mistakes of the past can't be undone. Well, what can we do now to help the consumer deleverage their position and get the economy back together?
Well, that's a hard question for me, because this is where I don't think the Obama administration did enough. I think that they should have, and I don't think the Federal Reserve did enough. What they did in 2008 and 2009 is they basically refinanced the banking industry. They refinanced the financial system. And the Republicans did this, and I think it was needed to do to sort of stop the whole thing collapsing. But we should have then extended that assistance to the middle class, to individual households. They too, their balance sheets were a mess. They'd overborrowed to buy these inflated houses. What we needed to do was get them refinancing quickly and on the cheap. And this had to be done through the Federal Reserve and the federal government. The federal government now was in charge of owned Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and could therefore essentially own the mortgages that were in trouble. It could have made refinancing available, with the Federal Reserve going in there and buying the new loans that would have come out of Fannie and Freddie. And had we pushed interest rates down to 3.5% where they are now, a lot of foreclosures and bankruptcies wouldn't have happened. And I think the Obama administration failed here. It got bad advice. Mind you, when I criticize them, I'm not praising the Republicans. The Republicans were even more oppositional to doing something. And had we had some help from the Republicans, I think maybe we could have pushed some of this stuff. But the last people in the world that the Republicans wanted to help was the middle class homeowner. That would have, they thought, would have hurt the profits of the banks who owned the mortgages at a higher interest rate. So that's really, we're doing that now, by the way, but unfortunately, it's a bit like closing the barn door after the horse has bolted. This is what should have been done right away. Since it was done later, we got into a much deeper housing collapse. There's a lot more to be done. I mean, if you'd like me to go on to other pieces that we can do, and which the Obama administration has been doing and would like to do more of, I can do that.
Yes, we're very interested in practical solutions and things that actually could be done by the Obama administration when it's reelected.
Okay.
We've got 3 minutes, Tom.
3 minutes. I'll give you three different things.
I hate to do that to an economist telling me he has 3 minutes to finish up a point.
Okay.
But,
3 minutes, or 1 minute for each proposal. The next thing is we've got to get wages growing again. We've got to get wages connected to productivity growth. That was the secret of the period from 1945 to 1975 when we had shared prosperity. That means we're going to have to raise the minimum wage, bring up the floor of the economy, and we're going to have to make it possible for workers to share in their productivity growth by building unions again. We're going to need to reform labor law to do that, because we can't have unions when every time you have a former union, the firm busts it. Number two, we're going to have to deal with our trade deficit and our problem of our overvalued dollar. You know, the trouble is we've got this massive deficit with China and other countries sucking in imports, displacing American production, displacing American exports. But, of course, all the big multinationals, you know, the caterpillars of the world, are opposed to that, because then they won't make money on their production platforms that are overseas. And then we're going to have to do something about with the public investment that we need. We need to put some juice in the economy while we wait for these other measures to take effect. Now's the time, when interest rates are low, to invest in the infrastructure we need. But to do that, of course, we're going to have to also make sure that these Bush tax cuts expire, because they suck all the money out of the Treasury that could be used to finance these other activities, creating jobs in the U.S.
And, Tom, you have a new book out. Tell us about it. We're running out of time.
Yeah, this new book is a collection of essays, short essays that I've written, that try and explain little pieces of the puzzle and show that, you know, help people understand how globalization works, help people understand our relationship with China, how it's corrupted by corporations, help people understand how monetary policy and what the Federal Reserve has been doing. And also to let people read about the past. And when people say that the crisis wasn't predictable, That's not true. It was predictable. It's the economists that were blind.
Thank you very much for being with us today. Next week, we're going to take up what's supposed to be a terrible, terrible a scandal. We're going to take up Solera, the Solyndra controversy about how Solyndra went bankrupt. We're going to talk about investment in American technology. You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.